На гору залез и с нее кидаться. Очень много шансов есть.
The lodgings, gardens, and stables of a society run by a series of groups must be vastly different from those of our villages and towns, which are perversely organized and meant for families having no societary relations. Instead of the chaos of little houses which rival each other in filth and ugliness, a phalanx constructs for itself a building as perfect as the terrain permits. The centre of the palace, or phalanstery, should be a place for quiet activity. It should include the dining rooms, the exchange, meeting rooms, library, studies, etc. This central section includes the temple, the tower, the telegraph, the coops for carrier pigeons, the ceremonial chimes, the observatory, and a winter courtyard adorned with resinous plants.
Hello, I'm George Ginzel.
I'm Luke Jones.
This is About Buildings and Cities.
We've got to wrap up monasteries and try and cash some of the various checks that we wrote a couple of episodes ago when we sketched this long historical arc from the origins of monastic life towards the organisational complex in architecture, the dream of a different life, the problem of the individual minimal dwelling, the symbolisation of eternity and all that kind of thing, which we're going to do through exploring, I think, three or four little mini episodes stretching between the start of the 19th century and the middle of the 20th. And that will just have to do, I'm afraid. So I think the starting point for our story here is the work of Charles Fourier, who was a Lyonnais cloth merchant, but really the originator of utopian socialism. He was a kind of prodigious writer about the possibility of a society organized in a different way, addressing a whole series of different social problems, from the problem of kind of oppression, work, poverty, unhappiness, the unfreedom of women, the oppression of all sorts of different people for different reasons, all rolled into this extremely definite and detailed blueprint for an ideal society taking place in this thing called the phalanstery, which is a wonderfully sort of vividly imagined building for a community of about 1,600 people.
It's typical, I suppose, of the people we're talking about. It includes a number of interesting and enlightened ideas and a number of things which are completely bats.
Yeah. It's interesting, maybe just to, we could just conclude one little strain that's run through the monastery's discussion so far. Early on, when he tries to kind of reach for possible antecedents to a building of this scale, he says that there aren't really. That you could think of the Palace of Versailles, or you could think of the great monastery palace built by the Spanish, Philip? Escorial, but really none of them are quite right. I mean, I think Escorial is interesting because it's actually a palace monastery fusion, which becomes this sort of paradigmatic early modern administrative organizational complex. It's like this massive big quadrangular thing divided into four, with four big courtyards and a big church in the middle.
I haven't been there. It's an incredible statement. The first thing is, I'm a king, I'm going to live in a monastery. I mean, his whole reign is about, we are going to smash the Reformation. Again, rather like with Charlemagne at the beginning, this stamp authority of we're going to bring Catholic orthodoxy, use the power of these priests.
It's a sort of bank vault of religious orthodoxy and kind of spiritual power, and you sort of charge it all up. And also there's lots and lots, like the Escorial, I think, is they were the Order of Saint Jerome, who are Augustinians, so they are not really, they're actually priests who live as monks, rather in the same way as a lot of these other ones. So they're going out into the purpose really is to be in the world and be like fighting the battle for the true faith. They also have this kind of quasi-military kind of monastic.
They're definitely going out into the new world and the empire, the Spanish Empire. Right from the beginning, they're asking for like send guns and Franciscans. And you get lots of the monastery type. There are interesting things, but they become more and more like quadrangular office blocks. The wall is integrated into the building. The cells become less like they become more like rooms in a big building than sort of separate dwellings. We've got a long way from the hermit, and it is much more like Versailles, where huge amounts of people live in that palace and operate within an institution, an organization devoted to a cause. Obviously, the organizing principle is very different, but we're not really going to talk about those. Mentioning, though, because it sort of sets up what the big generation of monastic big building projects of that period, which are bigger and they are much more like singular buildings. Sure, they can have like detached churches and things, absolutely, but like the big building with serried ranks of windows is a much bigger part of it.
So back to Fourier. So he's in Lyon. Lyon is a big cloth town. Cloth is a big part of its wealth historically. And he had lived through the French Revolution and also then was writing this under Napoleon. So he had sort of seen a bit of history and was basically writing it, I think, at night. This is classic manic genius, really. Writing enormously sort of voluminous essays about just solving all the problems at the same time, being super precise, never like doubting anything for a minute, and really working it all out.
It doesn't strike you as a guy with a reverse gear.
No.
There's a lot of yes and.
He has also his thing, which is much sort of satirized and kind of commented on is that he is an inveterate like taxonomist. He categorizes everything. All of his theories are built upon these sort of systems that he's made for himself. So he has a theory of the human passions, which are divided into different sorts. You know, you have sort of passions which are sort of more or less refined, which are more or less connected to different sorts of either bodily or intellectual pleasures. And then he has a kind of theory of personality types where people are more or less dominated by certain of those passions, either singly or in combinations which he imagines as kind of like tonal harmonies of different kinds. So you can be polytonal, sort of like duotone, tritone. He thinks rare to go above five.
It's like, we're going to take the humoral system. We're going to take this to the next level. It's not going to be four humours. We're going to have loads.
So, yeah, you know, you have pleasures which are associated with the senses, pleasures which are associated with society and, you know, this kind of natural sort of human society, and pleasures which are associated with the sort of the intellect, fundamentally. I mean, his thing, really, was that he thought that all of the evils of society came from civilization, which he defined as this sort of set of rules and norms which force people to do things that they don't want to do, and that all of the kind of problems would go away if people were able to be authentically themselves in a sort of unashamed way, to indulge their kind of constructive pleasure in doing and making, in being with one another.
Sounds like he may have read Rousseau.
I think he had, but also was a critic of it. Yeah, he has a funny bit about Rousseau where he's like, yeah, Rousseau, who had so much confidence in his theories about education that he didn't do any of them to any of his children. Pleasure is natural. Pleasure is healthy. The desires of the body and the mind are natural and healthy, which are for food, for company, for society, for sex. He thought that sexual desire, including homosexual desire, was natural, and that people should find ways to kind of indulge it with one another in through kind of mutual negotiation of various kinds, which he imagines being, in some cases, he sort of imagines there's like a big exchange at the center of the phalanstery where you go to negotiate what you're going to do over the next 20 days also, which includes like, well, the day after tomorrow, I'm going to spend 2 days shoveling horse dung, no, 2 hours shoveling horse dung, and I need a buddy to do it with, and then also I'm looking to have sex with someone of this kind of temperament on Friday. And
they would have to wait for hundreds of years before smartphones offered a lot of this.
There's a quite funny passage. I wonder if it's worth reading out, but where he describes how this exchange will work. He's done the math of like, oh God, well, if everyone in this community has to negotiate with everyone else and all of the different possible combinations who are affected, it will take literally all of the time that's available. So you have people who are kind of representatives of those of their passionate disposition, their sort of personality type. They kind of do a lot of the negotiation together and they can communicate with each other by iron wires, which sort of pull mechanically and can convey information to to the different points in the different sort of deuses inside the exchange.
Horse dung, pull, sex hour.
It's a sort of stock exchange, like, yeah. but with kind of like piano wire going everywhere to connect everybody.
Yeah.
We'll talk literally about the building a bit more in a second, but it's very high tech.
Lot of mod cons. They never go away from this. I mean, all of these, they love conveniences, ingenious conveniences. Like, we can just get rid of the problem with a contraption.
It's interesting that when he describes the center of the phalanstery, there's a sort of signal tower, there's carrier pigeons, there's what he calls a telegraph, but which must be a flag telegraph.
I think it's a semaphore telegraph. There were ones which used flags, but there were other ones which used, like semaphore, the raising and lowering of arms, and you could kind of chain them together to do long distance messaging. There were commercial systems.
Yeah, where's the bit? You said there's a bit where it's all about how people are going to want to read the news as well.
Yes, it was. As people arrive for the meal, they're able to read reports and news dispatches which have arrived during the night. They learn about the plays performed in neighbouring phalanxes, about the movements of caravans and industrial armies, the voyages of various paladins of the globe. In addition, they find various newspapers have arrived which during the night, either from the Congress of Unity, which is located on the Bosphorus, or from the secondary congresses of the Amazon, Chesapeake, etc. It's very strange to read because it's got, I think some of his notions about society are kind of nice and fun. So the idea is we should have a community which allows people to live their best lives. The goal is very different to a monastery. They're not trying to serve God. They're trying to become their best selves.
And to be happy, yeah.
Be happy, yes. And through being happy, they will be kind and generous and fulfilled. Their senses, needs, intellectual and physical desires will be fulfilled. And they will live harmoniously in an interesting and diverse society, which will be created by accommodating communally all of those needs.
And on terms of equality between the sexes as well.
Yeah. For everyone. And then it's just like, but also it's real fantasy stuff.
It's an incredibly detailed fantasy.
Like, who are the paladins?
I don't know who the paladins are. This is rather lovely.
They seem to be mentioned in passing and then not talked about again. Those are the knights of Charlemagne, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. Well, they're just they're wandering the globe doing various things.
Yeah, or like some sort of Dungeons and Dragons class, which probably does smiting and healing in combination.
Yes, lawful good. Well, one of the things which I find interesting about it is the thing about that everyone wants to read the news about all of these things and that the world is kind of joined together in this kind of information web, so that there's a simultaneous thing of sort of what enables this living communally and in a way which is sort of cut off from the world, at least socially. There's an idea that it's a kind of social unit where people can sort of travel between them, but it, like, you really belong to the community that you're a part of.
Yeah, they're kind of like a kibbutz, right, in some ways. They've got all their own stuff. They're not utterly out of the world. You might have some people staying there who are not kibbutz people.
Yeah, I think he does have ideas that people do sort of move goods around and trade them, and, you know, you'll send your watermelon surplus up to Estonia or whatever, but certainly socially they are meant to be kind of self-supporting.
Yeah, and capitalism is going on in them.
I wouldn't say it's capitalism. Certainly commerce isn't really going on in them. Essentially, the whole phalanstery is like a joint stock company. So everyone receives a basic income and a place to live, a like minimum dwelling. Then in proportion to your contribution, you're also paid back from the profit from the community. Okay. So you can get rich through being extremely industrious and creative. And there's a kind of profit motivation. But it's not clear what you would do with any of that money except for spend it on yourself, because you can't invest it in production, which is all part of the commune.
And how does your industry help?
This is slightly vague, how the phalanstery makes money in the world of phalansteries. But that's the principle, is that your contribution to the community gets sort of paid back to you in part.
Your investment contribution and your labour contribution.
I mean, the idea is that no one should be compelled to work, and that if you don't do any work at all, you still have a minimum income and a place to live. But he thought that people naturally want to work, which I think is true, isn't it? Like, people naturally want to do things. And that if the compulsion to work was taken away, everyone would do the kind of work which they naturally felt kind of drawn to and wanted to do. But then there is also some possibility of deriving like a bit of a fringe benefit out of it, that I guess he probably does understand that, you know, it is sort of rewarding also when you do some work and then you get some money from it.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I don't think those are the key things. That just kind of colours the goals of the society, the goals of the building design and the social design are in many ways monastic. They are trying to create a community. The building is to embody and encourage particular styles of life and is to encourage people to be a particular sort of way.
The facilities are by and large communal, and apartments are small and minimal. And what you have in your minimum dwelling is a place to sleep. You have a private toilet and what he calls an alcove. I don't really know what the alcove is for, but which is, you know, very similar to a kind of monastic cell. That's what you have.
Yeah, I mean, it's a vestigial monastic bit.
You eat in common. There's like communal kitchens and things, and people who have more money can have more rooms, but it's not really clear why they would want to. He says that it's unlikely that anyone would want to have more than three or four, because the ones that you share are much nicer. There are lots of illustrations of this, because people did get really into the idea, and they are generally these long kind of staggering blocks, looking a bit like the sort of snake game from the Nokia phone or whatever, with quite a shallow plan. So he describes that the block is 8 toises, so it's four meters more or less is the depth of the block,
which is not very deep.
That's not very deep, no. Actually, circulation around it is not included in that, which is through this miraculous thing called the street gallery, which he thinks is like a great innovation. I wonder if we can find a quote about it, because he describes it in "The poorest wretch in Harmony, a man who doesn't have a penny to his name, has a well-heated and enclosed portico at his disposal. When he gets into a carriage, he goes from the palace to the stables by means of paved and gravelled underground passageways. He gets from his lodgings to the public halls and workshops by means of street galleries, which are heated in winter and ventilated in summer. In Harmony, one can pass through the workshops, stables, shops, ballrooms, banquet and assembly halls, etc. in January without knowing whether it is rainy or windy, hot or cold. The street gallery, which is the most important feature of a phalanstery and which cannot be conceived of in civilization." It's important to say that in Fourier, civilization is like a term of abuse.
Fallen state.
He's a very ironic writer.
There's a lot of that around France at the time. There's some good ones in the encyclopedia.
So the street gallery is this, which you sort of see illustrated, is kind of glazed.
It might be like an arcade.
Yeah, it's a bit like an arcade. It's a thing which didn't exist at the time.
It's heated. It's on the first floor, English first floor, which would be American second floor.
The apartments all come off it. Some of them are on one level. Some of them
They're across three levels. So
yeah, but you go up. I think it's on one level, but you go up. It says that you can go upstairs to the apartments, which are. I don't really know how you fit all this into such a shallow plan.
It doesn't make any sense. Below, there are the rooms for the children and the grandparents, and also all the banqueting halls and things. And you can lower stuff through trapdoors in the gallery. And then on that floor are the people likely to be coupling, which means like adolescents and things. Are people in the sort of later prime of their life, I think, on the floor above? I can't remember.
The street gallery is not very wide. It's sort of 2 to 3 meters wide in his description.
you know, like the sort of thing you'd walk around Padua in.
Yeah, it's like a corridor.
But it's a magical corridor.
It's a lovely magical corridor. I think
it's full of trapdoors that lower like delicious suckling pigs into dining halls.
The most famous depiction of the phalanstery is this one, which looks like, well, I don't know, it's a sort of Tetris shape. It's like a very long, thin perimeter block going all the way around the outside of this thing, which looks a little bit like an inverted V at very low pixel density.
I mean, it's worth saying, you do get in French architecture of the period or a bit earlier, very tall, thin residential buildings. So like a lot of the elite urban residential, you know, the Hotel Particulier, the ones that are not super grand will often be very thin. This is a sort of two courtyard house type. And they often will be very thin, and it lets in light in these kind of tight, and it's very pleasant to have these, like, it means you can have single rooms with dual aspects. Freezing cold.
He's got a bee in his bonnet about something at the point that he's come up with this idea, hasn't he? The idea that wouldn't it be nice if you didn't have to ever go outside to get anywhere?
Yes.
Probably, yeah. Someone has splashed him with their cart or...
Yeah, I also think he doesn't like the disorder and muck of the outside world.
How nice it would be to just wander endlessly on the first floor looking down at it. Yeah, in this most famous one, they kind of cut across the internal courtyard of this very long, thin, strange-looking palace.
To just kind of clarify how the palace works.
Yeah.
It has industry, residential bits, and lots of sort of communal services. So there's communal provision of cooking and washing and horses and all that sort of stuff operated off. Children do all the disgusting things because they are disgusting.
He's observed that children love dirt. And so he's kind of inferred from that. He has this theory that you can have this gang of children who will do the most disgusting work. They will be called, he calls them the Little Horde.
And they will clean all the latrines. Or
yeah, he thinks there are sort of two-thirds of boys who love filth so much that they will do that.
It's an absurdity in every paragraph. But this was very influential. People devoted their lives to setting up communities like this. And I think we should try and kind of take it seriously. And it's clearly a descendant of monasticism and clearly an antecedent of a number of sort of socialist communities. The fact that it's a monastery devoted to joy, you're, instead of stripping away everything from life which stops you being able to think about God, you're stripping away everything of life that's a pain in the neck. You're stripping away all the inconveniences of having lots of stuff. You have a couple of rooms, everything's taken care of, and there's just spaces for you to do everything. You know, if you're into Kabbalistic rites, there are Kabbalistic rites organizations with small rooms available for your every need. If you're into free love, there's a free love dating agency communicated by long wire cords that will sort out your needs on a 20-day basis, which can be renegotiated every evening if there are alterations.
There's a consensus that like sort of 2-hour packages are how you break things down. Yeah. 2 hours of shoveling, 2 hours of lunch, 2 hours of horse riding, 2 hours of robust sexual congress with strapping young somebody or other. Dinner with great conversation.
Yes, lowered through trapdoors in the ceiling.
I mean, a lot of Marx is sort of dedicated to saying that really this is not really the way in which we bring about change in the world, imagining these sort of strange science fictions. And actually,
well, it also comes at peak, or at least the start of this is peak political disillusion, right? The French Revolution was very exciting. And then it was very scary and violent and exciting. And then it stabilized into a military dictatorship. A military dictatorship which modelled itself extensively on the thing it had overthrown. Now, a lot of progress had been made. It wasn't what came out at one end was not at all what came in at the other end. But if you were a dreamer, the realities of the world were not going to be what would satisfy your dreaming instincts in the later part of the first decade of the 19th century in France. You've seen that real amazing things can happen. And a load of really quite nuts things did. You know, suddenly we're inventing religions all the time. I mean, it didn't require much to knock the cult of reason on its head. I mean, and the idea that, okay, you're all going to, you know, we're going to reinvent the calendar with all these sort of funny months and decimalized time. It's very funny, the way it's written.
It's delightful, and I think he's a very attractive... I mean, no doubt he had some things wrong with him, but he's a very attractive figure in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But as I haven't found it in the reading, in the primary reading, but in an article about him, it said that he had a kind of theory that due to cosmic events, the seas were going to change from salty to lemon tasting. For some kind of reason. He had like a deep theory of history, which was inspired by a kind of harmonic mathematics. And so he could plot like 80,000 years into the future.
And it's going to be more or less the same, except that the sea is going to taste lemony.
To spend a winter's day in a phalanstery, to visit all parts of it without exposure to the elements, to go to the theatre and the opera in light clothes and coloured shoes without worrying about the mud and the cold, would be a charm so novel that it alone would suffice to make our cities and castles seem detestable.
A lot of these people from the past, that a lot of the things that they're inventing already exist and are now pedestrian.
Ahead of his time.
This was taken up. People did try to do this on a very small scale in the 1840s, particularly in America. I don't know a lot about the outcome. Given that a lot of the qualities of it are essentially impossible, I think you would have to boil it down to the kind of communal... the idea of communal living and industry, and it would become a sort of socialist commune.
There's an idea that with a certain communal scale, kind of conceivable and designable as a totality, that that's a sort of precondition for making life work properly. I think that's the necessity of working at this particular scale. That's why it can't be twice as big. It's big, but it's not... I think if it was twice as big, it becomes formless.
It's a very large village. You wouldn't know everyone in it.
But this idea of the designed community, which has to be at a scale where it's possible to kind of design it. Yeah, I think that the two go together, and that's its connection to monasticism, is that it is the design of a way of life together in its architectural and sort of social dimensions.
Yeah, I mean, also, he's literally taking... the design of the minimum dwelling is kind of monastic in it. It's more monastic than an apartment in a palace, which would be the other thing he's talking about. It's very difficult to know exactly what he had in mind, though, as well, because it's like Schierbart. There's an atmosphere, glass plate destroys hate, and an ambition. His is more worked out. Like, what we've got to do is we've got to crack it so that we can have a system whereby... it's like living in a wonderful hotel. And you also work in the wonderful hotel.
The other thing which is which is sort of connected to the monastery, is that, like, in asceticism, kind of have to think all about the body in order to free yourself from the body. You end up designing around the body and the fundamental requirements of the body so that you can kind of be freed from that. Yeah. But you can also...
you can go, well, why don't we just... make it as nice as possible.
Yeah, yeah. it all becomes about value added. All the essentials are there.
But essential to that is to be part of this moral community. The building is separating you from an immoral world. And I think also the idea that if you can use this architectural environment to like satisfy people's passions, they will be happy and kind. They will become their best selves.
I wanted to say, just as a sort of postscript to this as well, that there is an interesting fusion of it and the Crystal Palace in a novel called What Is to Be Done. Later, the title then again reused by Lenin in his book, but written in 1860s by Nikolai Chernyshevsky. So the idea of the Crystal Palace as the sort of utopian community trope, particularly in Russian science fiction, it's that's the like master trope from Chernyshevsky onwards. So when we talked about We by Yevgeny Zamyatin, that's very consciously riffing on the sort of established model of what utopia looks like, which is a glass palace. Yeah, no, What Is to Be Done sort of is the story of a woman called Vera Pavlovna, And, you know, she has to do all of these ridiculous things that society requires of her, and she has to have a kind of marriage for economic reasons and all these sorts of things. But she's interested in the problem of what of the same problem of kind of freedom, what it would take to have a society where people would be able to kind of fundamentally like fulfill their desire for sort of self-expression and self-realization. And she has a famous dream in towards the end of the novel, which is this dream of Fourier style philanthropy, but this in which in this case is directly modeled on the Crystal Palace of the Great Exhibition. And it's a sort of technological updating. It's all made of aluminium, the new wonder material, the material of the future.
I remember they're out in the fields farming, and like a canopy shades them, sort of flies around shading them from the sun.
Yeah, it's very high tech. They have like water spraying blinds, canopies of all kinds. Anyway, you know, it's 100 years too early. Essentially, it's the like vision of them.
Yes,
the high tech vision.
Quite like it seemed like the shepherds in Arcadia, like they're all bringing in the haymaking, like in News from Nowhere, except they're robotically assisted. They're having gentle puffs of air. When the sun is too bright, a screen comes over, but still bringing in the hay in this bucolic sort of setting.
I don't know that it necessarily adds that much more to the vision, except for this is this kind of very interesting like technological updating and like a true fusion of it with proper mature period industrial
revolution. I mean, I really feel that this is still like people are still on this game. It's still like sort of all watched over by machines of love and grace, is kind of.
But he's not completely wrong either. Like, I feel like Fourier's, or in the way he thinks of technology, for example, I think that it's very intriguing, some of his ideas about how people are going to use these new forms of media to kind of live different sorts of lives and to collaborate in ways that would be impossible otherwise.
Yeah, the problem of how to cooperate.
Solved by technology.
Obstacles to cooperation. Well, I mean, you were talking about Russia. Obviously, communities do get together and attempt these sort of social communes themselves, particularly in America. But you can never really imagine the production of anything with the kind of economic capability to make these sort of wonderful utopian monastic communities work until it's got a powerful backer. The first plausible candidate comes along when you have the revolution in Russia. And suddenly, the utopian dreams of how we're going to make this ideal, people have to actually really think about how to do it. And there is a phase after the death of Lenin and before things sort of get really nailed down into, we're just going to build massive buildings with like weird bits of classicism stuck on the outside of them. When a number of the people who had existed as kind of utopian thinkers before the revolution have a chance to do a lot of thinking, certainly about building, and building a few examples of attempts to make communal living where the kind of humdrum needs of life are removed so that you can be a perfect citizen, a like free body of someone who has had their needs taken care of, and then able to be the sort of great social communal person you always could, you know, want to be, at the same time as having your time freed for work as well. So that life, everything that isn't work and pleasure is kind of taken care of.
So, I mean, communal living, particularly in the big cities, was kind of already fait accompli because like they brought lots of people in, but the standard thing were like repurposed bourgeois apartments, which I've learned from this book that we've been reading were called Komunalka, which were like not very nice. I mean, they're essentially the way that we now everyone under the age of about 50 lives in cities.
Well,
now, but
except that you don't have to share your little tiny flat with various other families.
Yeah, you don't have a family in every room, but
it's worth saying before the revolution there were massive industrial dormitories and people were very much forced together. The cities had been growing enormously and there were all sorts of rather undesirable forms of collective living going on as a necessity.
There's an interesting story told about these in the Dogma book Loveless, which is this like history of minimum dwelling. For these architects, there's a clear antecedent which they're interested in, which is American residential hotels. These like massive urban buildings full of little corridor, little minimum dwellings around light wells and things.
I imagine them as like bachelor sets. You know, like you used to have all around St. James. You'd have all these little tiny like miniature one-room flats, but for kind of comfortable people who essentially were expected to eat out all the time.
Maybe.
And have someone do their... But it almost how they are in reality doesn't matter because they're kind of reflected through this, you know, like we had with Kafka's America. We're like looking at the American Wonderland, the white heat coming to us across a shrinking sea.
Definitely. And then, so there's a period really like the late 20s and then right at the start of the 30s, there's a whole series of these proposals for like what can you do with a minimum dwelling? Almost none of which are built. The famous one which was built is the Narkomfiden building in Moscow, which we think we talked about already on our Palace of the Soviets episode. It was by Moshe Ginsburg. There are two types of apartments in it. There's one which is a pure like one room apartment, which is just really a bedroom, and the idea is you kind of use all your communal facilities. And then there's another type which is a sort of split level but still very compact apartment. They're served by these kind of corridors, communal kitchen dining on the ground floor.
That feels like it is taking something like the German social housing from before the First War. And in fact, they were developed around this time as well. Extremely small flats in communal blocks. But the kind of organization of like these extremely small flats, which have got everything you need in them, they're self-contained flats. But the kind of core of making it practical is you make everything small and kind of use as much infrastructure to reduce down what is required to give people like a reasonable have... people eating in a refectory, the idea that, well, we can get even more out of it if we can do all the laundry and all that sort of stuff in a big, just put that in a big plant at the end of the site. And then you really can have an ideal dwelling, theoretically, with just a room.
Yeah. It, rather than having 100 rubbish bedrooms, rubbish tiny kitchens, rubbish bathrooms, what if you just have a bedroom?
Yeah.
And everything else, you have a great
I'm
one.
I'm sure you've been in this position. I mean, I know I haven't done any of this for ages, but like position where someone goes, well, we've got to get three flats on this floor. You're like, oh, wow, it's 19 square meters, 20 square meters, 24 square meters. Well, each of those would be a nice bedroom.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, what if I didn't have to put this kitchenette and this shower room in that otherwise what would be quite a nice bedroom? Well,
it would be a different sort of vibe.
Yeah.
There's also a social dimension of all of this, which is that through communalizing those things, you are freed from the drudgery of housework, which is a big, you know, in the pre-washing machine, pre-dishwasher, pre-everything else world, is a real, produces an enormous amount of free time for the average woman, particularly in that era, to get rid of all of those things. Like the amount of time per week, I can't remember, there is a figure for like the amount of time per week that women used to spend on just laundry, which is just like astronomically large.
Because there came a time when it was decided you have to have clean clothes. And it came before there was any particularly convincing method of cleaning them.
There's a famous polemic by a Czech architect called Karel Tiger on minimum dwelling, where he makes exactly this case that like, if we're thinking about idea of kind of efficient use of resources and of providing dwellings which are an existential kind of minimum requirement, it's much better if we could communalize these facilities and have better versions of them rather than having lots and lots of tiny
but
rubbish
also
ones.
It fits obviously with the Soviet worldview, which is that jump-starting the movement forward in social development. We're going to skip all of that stuff that Marx talks about and we're going to get straight there. And to get straight there, we kind of have to improve humanity. We have to make a new person who is their better self. And we can sort of do that by living by rather like the phylactery. We will become better, stronger people by living fulfilled lives, so we don't have to think about the day-to-day grind in quite the same way. We can focus on building the strong, powerful nation and being enlightened people.
This is an intuition which reaches right back into monasticism, the idea that the lived form of everyday experience is fundamentally kind of connected with your understanding and your innermost sort of understanding of the world. You know, it's part of being a monk is that your everyday life becomes an act of worship, and that the work is also an act of worship. Often literally you're like hoeing the plants and sort of saying a prayer, a certain rhythm along with it. Everything is absolutely narrated along these lines. And in the same way, obviously, you're trying to materially and socially embody these new principles and this new form of life where people will live it as like kind of immediate sort of that's just their reality. You don't really have to try very hard if the kind of reality which you sort of live in without even trying is kind of constructing your way of seeing the world in a particular way.
People have suggested that in order for people to live their sort of best lives, you could give everyone a minimum income. And in a way, this is kind of skipping all of that and saying, we will provide for your body. And also, we will provide structures for the organising of other things.
Ivan Leonidov, who we talked about in the bonus, with regard to other things, has a scheme for Magnitogorsk, where there's a famous communal house design, which is sort of a big square.
This is such a whack design. It looks so cool as a graphic. Like, I can't really wrap my head around how this is meant to be good.
It's like a square divided into nine. So the four corner squares are each have two minimum rooms in. And then there's a kind of cross-shaped communal space. It's quite enigmatic what's in it. I think this was some of the ones which were all drawn on chalkboards.
There are real diagrams of that. And then that one goes into a grid, which is like repeating nine square grids. And then the city is just that nine square grids in one direction.
Becoming massive.
For like miles and miles and miles of this grid of nine sites, each one of which has potentially a nine gridded thing. I don't get it at all. It looks really cool.
But what's sort of infilling between them in the larger grid is an awful lot of nature, plants.
Yeah.
Also things which look like big running tracks or kind of other things for, you know, the like indulgence of the life of the body.
It feels much more, though, Corb's block in nature. Going down the monastic antecedents, I think the phalanstery, you're always inside it. The one quality that monasteries have is wall separation. The phalanstery, like, you're also set, like there's a kind of airlock to the outside world, like in the monastery with the airlock chapel, and you've got this airlock kind of caravanserai. The socialist social housing, obviously you're expected to go and work in a massive factory.
But they're all interspersed within the long strip, factory housing.
I mean, they actually did build in Magnitogorsk. There's like worker village factory, because the factory, I mean, it's a steel town, right? You obviously separate them because it's kind of extraordinarily polluting the industries. I feel that one's coming out of the more expansive tradition. It's the kind of matte city, where it's a city made of repeating and similar units.
The kind of the idea of the monastic cell is still there, but it's been kind of abstracted and placed within this different kind of logic, which is like a massive network, kind of linear transport logic.
What are we talking about when we're talking about the monastic cell as opposed to a house? I think there is a difference, but I...
Well, that kind of sort of sublimation where the like symbolic locations of spiritual offices become actually the symbolic locations of the life of the body instead. So swimming pool, running track, like forest path.
Oh my God, they're all going to be so buff. They're all going to be around those little white shorts. And they're all going to be all muscly running through nature. It's going to be great.
Yeah. People are extremely hale and hearty. They eat well.
It doesn't work though. Humans aren't like that. This is a sort of, I haven't mentioned it up to this point, but like, we don't just cooperate, people. We also kind of compete, oppose each other, and don't always get along with our neighbours. It's very hard to get around that through building. Because also, mind-body complex also desires novelty. And always having, like, it would be fantastic to go and visit the phalanstery. But how great is it to live there? difficult to know. I mean, it's kind of so fantastical. But it is closed. It is sort of the same thing. And it imagines a world of different the same things. The strength of the monastery is you can take one sort of person. And they're not meant to be having a good time. It's an appealing notion, but it worries me that they end up like shared housing or like really ritzy student blocks. They always, from Corb onwards, or from as an example, have like, well, we're going to have these things which solve problems and make things nice. You know, the amount of time he devoted to how everyone's allotment is going to work, which is so far outside his competence, it feels very ambitious. Because ultimately, you've got to overcome people's dislike of some of their neighbours in the village, in the perfect village, by providing them with services that mean that they like each other.
The thing also which is missed, I mean, I think it's very liberating. Yeah, it's true that it's liberating, the minimum dwelling concept, not having to worry about any of the like life admin. But also, I mean, part of the reason why people like having houses is because the sort of the project of like homemaking, of making space, the kind of spatial project of like inhabitation as a sort of process of like self-formation.
Part of building up your identity in yourself.
I mean, denied to many, but you know.
to varying extents, right? Putting a picture up on the wall is a start, you know. Just having a room and everything else isn't yours. It's kind of precarious.
There is something missing in the middle between those two things.
Like, it works in a monastery because you are meant to be bare in front of God. You should feel exposed and you should feel deeply connected to these symbolic organizations. There are lots of ways you can use architectural tools to make symbols. It's difficult for them to satisfy human interpersonal and personal needs like the creation of identity.
There's no non-normative housing model out there.
But some are less controlling of your entire life. These visions are like really controlling. And that's what the monastic tool is. The monastic tool isn't you're going to live in a house and go to work. It's every moment of your life is going to be defined by this machine. It's stepping outside identity. Monks aren't meant to have so much identity. Isn't that the point? You all wear the same, do the same. The interesting thing about the early Soviet project is they're not Maosut. They're meant to be able to, like the phalanstery, accommodate everybody's desires.
As much as they are about, well, this would be good and this would produce sort of probably quite politically correct subjects, it is also an attempt to post-rationalise an already existing situation, which is like overcrowding, shared housing of a certain kind, and like, well, this is probably a reality we have to live with, so, but what is the way in which it could be done which would be sort of sane and humane and would actually allow people to flourish rather than being rather dreary?
I wanted to talk about La Tourette, because I know we haven't kind of done a big arc history of all the Western monasteries at all, but we did some of the early things, and
so we're talking about La Tourette is the designed by Le Corbusier, and it's a Dominican community originally. Again, we've kind of returned to Lyon. It's sort of near Lyon, built in 1960. It's
I think started a little earlier than that. Built through that period. It's the last, I think, for me, anyway, I'm not an expert on kind of modern religious movements of Europe, but it feels to me that after the war, there was a religious awakening in Western Europe, both with more people becoming a sort of, I guess people came back from the war. There was a sudden, even in the Anglican Church, where a lot more people becoming priests. There's also a kind of wave of evangelical movement. It's the most recent time in Europe when you've suddenly got a need for lots of new religious buildings, which hasn't really happened subsequently. But that means that actually in many places, the aspiration, I mean, often rather like with the Victorians, The buildings arrive kind of a little bit after
the need is there, yeah.
Kind of just as the peak is kind of, you know, going down again.
Yeah.
Because they're so blooming. Someone has to think of it, get the money together, design it, build it. But this is probably the most famous monastery of that period. And it's not just a monastery. It's a monastery and I think a...
It's a kind of quasi-seminary, isn't it? I believe they were Dominicans, but they're like, they're meant to go out into the world. There's not...
They're meant to do some years there and then finish.
There are fathers who live on site, but the primary function of it is training. It seems like an extraordinary building. It's one of his most famous buildings. It's his last major European commission.
And it is definitely, first thing you say, it's definitely a monastery. A Dominican monastery. You would recognize it from the earlier descriptions. It's a quad. It's also definitely, yeah, it's a four-sided building around a cloister, sort of. One side's a church, the other side has got the various other functions in it. It's also definitely a Le Corbusier building. It's built on a slope. It stands on concrete piers so that it floats above the ground, mostly, except where it sort of hits the ground at the top end of the slope. So it's sort of...
So the ground is sort of as if it's sort of cut away below this sort of hovering horizontal block.
Yeah, I think slightly, I'm not sure if this is true. I too haven't been there. I've just looked at lots of drawings of it lots of times. I think the top of the roof line is exactly in line with the top of the hill. Whenever I criticise cool buildings before going to see them, I think, oh, this is a bit drab or whatever. And I go there and they're brilliant.
He was also joined for this. I mean, throughout this, he had lots of interesting young people working in the office. For this one, Yanis Xenakis, better known as a modernist composer, was involved. And I think had some hand in designing some of the like inner sculptural kind of.
Yeah, so I'll go through the elements because I can remember how it sort of comes together. From the outside, you've got three sides, one of which is a concrete blank wall, which is the chapel, which appears to be a complete concrete box, sort of more or less sealed from the outside, with a little sculptural bell tower protruding from it and the sort of funny shapes on either side, which is just set apart from the three-sided block. On the bottom two floors, these kind of cool strip windows, full height windows, which have got vertical glazing bars, which get closer and narrower. And I think it's that harmonic relationship where they'll go lot, less, lot, so that it's like a kind of barcode across the bottom. And then above that, you've got the cells on a couple of floors, which have little windows looking out over nature in a kind of cropped way.
They're laid out so that they look out of the outside of the three-sided courtyard block, and then the corridor is on the inside.
Which happened, like, when I first saw that, I thought, that's still wrong. I'm going to look out of the monastery. But actually, in between centuries, that's kind of become the norm.
Yeah, well, it's like charterhouses do that.
Yeah, charterhouses do that. You can look out as long as it's... never like a low level, but as long as it's a bit high, a bit separated, it's okay.
And the rooms, do you want to say something about... I mean, the rooms are this very famous kind of super minimal design. They're quite... they're very narrow, aren't they? They're long and narrow.
Rather like the Unite. If you've been to the Unite, the unit of the Unite, which is his... I mean, there were more than one of them built, but the famous one, I suppose, in Marseille, they're very long and thin. Like, in common with these other utopian things, the flats are tiny. Like, they're small, they could be double units, but, you know, to turn them into convincing hotel rooms, they have to make two flats into one hotel room in the hotel bit. Like, as in a double hotel room, you get two whole flats.
Yeah, of the single level ones, the split level ones.
Of the single level, there's much bigger, which are like 2.5 of those, I think, aren't they? Because it goes right across and then...
But the rooms are very much scaled to the, like, single bed, desk... window with a door leading out to the balcony.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's not an awful lot of room.
You get a wardrobe. There's a wardrobe which kind of blocks the two things apart as well. And the desk is in the end. Two thirds of it is like Kanga hammered concrete, and then one third of it is like smooth concrete for the meditation bit.
And it's like it's sort of 3x1 proportion, the plan. It's quite a kind of...
Yeah, but it's all based off golden sections and modular. We can talk about that some other time.
They look lovely.
Yeah, they look lovely. It's got some things, though, that so far so sort of okay, like this feels monastic. There's a lot of play with the wall, you know, what the perimeter is, because it's broken by the church being separate, but the church is so extraordinarily wall-like. It actually does have various continuous slit windows reflecting different sorts of light. There's one at the east end, there's one at the north end, and there's some ones which get indirect light, which are made of coloured glass, I think, or the interior is painted, but it's still sort of bunker language. And in fact, coming off that, there's what's called a crypt, but really it's got, used to have to do 7 masses a day, and it's got an altar for each of the offices. And there's a sacristy on the other side, which has got these really whack. I mean, in fact, both of them have very strange roof lights.
Yes, the light cannons. Yeah, the round things which are like painted inside so that they've got this like real glowing.
And one's got these kind of like extruded 4 or 5-sided shapes, which are kind of extruded out at funny angles, like crystals have been shoved through the roof, which is, again, kind of classic Corb. But then you go in the middle, it's very strange and very not classic monastery.
Yeah, so my theory of this is that it's sort of the sort of two sizes of cloister which are nested inside each other. So that there's the mega block of the rooms, which is a kind of cloister form, but it doesn't really, the view in is actually through a very thin slit window on the floors with the rooms. And then on the floors with the facilities, it's that kind of essentially curtain wall with the sort of strange louvers. But then it's subdivided, and closer to the church, there's another thing which is actually literally called the cloister, which is a purely sort of glazed walkway on a ramp, which connects around and is the main processional route into the church.
But it's really strange because the bottom of the courtyard, it's on, the whole thing is on columns.
Yeah, so the courtyard is kind of sloping away below you, yeah.
The outside looks pretty cool. It's got a lot of nice graphical things, but it's boxy. The inside has got a lot of complicated sculptural quality. It's not a calm, chilled out cloister where you contemplate your relationship with the infinite through void. It's got a big pyramid. It's got these funny light well things coming up through it. It's got a cross of ramped. The whole thing is divided into 4 with a cross of ramped sort of corridor, fully glazed corridors, which change level and go, you know, organize the movement through this kind of school bit in this diagrammatic circulation. There's also sort of other strange sculptural forms of other bits of things. I'm not entirely sure what they are, but it's really loud. Obviously, it's like all concrete.
Everything is in situ concrete.
Like kind of beautifully done, super precise, super rough.
Including these like miraculously sort of thin sculptural, glazing
mullions. They're like glazing bars.
Yeah, but somehow done out of concrete.
Like all of Cole's buildings.
They have refurbed this one.
The whole thing will have like peeled and split, and then they will have got some like unbelievable geniuses in to try and make this thing not work, some of which will be drilling holes in the walls.
Oh, it looks great. But you see also that this is the above, that's the corridor which the bedrooms are off, which is an incredibly thin slit window, almost like a bunker window.
So the columns go up and they have little lintels which the floors rest off, which stick out on either side of the top of the column. The column is completely embedded in the wall, and these little column headers make a kind of clerestory slit in the circulation spaces.
These are wild, these windows which are just in situ concrete. Yeah, they look like a quite complex sort of Mondrian-inspired window sort of composition. It's all made of concrete with glass infill. And then they've got their lovely library behind there.
It looks super beautiful. I'd love to go. Every time I've tried to go there, it's been closed for one reason or another. So I think basically it had one generation of students, which was that kind of period. And then there just aren't that many people taking up monastic vows these days. And I think there was a period, like with lots of these things, where its future was very uncertain. And I think it still has monks, but like the first time I nearly went, it had like 14 monks. And the last time I nearly went, it had 7.
It is a shame because it is very carefully designed for the kind of ceremony. You know, Corb obviously loves the like ceremonial functions.
Oh, he did proposals for like with way more ramps. and he just wanted them to like march around roots again and again. He's getting high off the sculptural qualities and the like ceremonial significance. He actually, although he loves the Carthusians, he's going a bit Baroque, isn't he? He's like...
Yeah, well, this is his period of like super sculptural. It's so good at this point. I mean, he's just got better and better and better, and these are just amazing. But it's also very interesting. What does this represent? So here is like modern architecture in its old age, and it's gone back to literally designing monasteries. Like, you know, we've gone through all of the sort of sublimated traces of it in the city for 3 million people or whatever they happen to be. And now we're just doing the real thing.
I felt like he kind of wanted to do that all the way through, really, the back of his mind. I mean, his mind was pushing against it, but his heart was always there. He loves asceticism in the sense of, it's not quite asceticism, it's the appreciation of an extremely minimal sensory experience.
I think also, but also primal and kind of fundamental pleasures of the body. Food, you know, he's still very motivated by, like, he's still like, I sort of think he's thinking back to going to Athos, sort of writing about,
wants,
you know.
He wants the perfect food to be a beautiful plate of beans.
Yeah, exactly. The perfect beans stand in your beautifully proportioned but otherwise bare room. You like work the heavy bag for, you know, 20, 25 minutes. Yeah. You go and eat the world's nicest tomato and some beans and like drink some wine. You go and see like mistress number three down the hall. Yeah. Then you go off for a drive in your car, you know, the wind in your... rushing past your spectacles, but like there's no guilt, there's no worry, there's just absolute kind of presence and sort of sensory and bodily delight.
Yeah, and in the way that this last monastery is that, but with symbolism, or with like with geometry standing in for symbol shaped things. And it's funny because it's one of these things which is much starker on the outside than the inside. And it subverts various things. But it is ultimately an extremely recognisable monastery. It's a type he didn't feel it was necessary really to subvert that much. It's a lot less subverted than a house.
Yeah, the qualities of those kind of Carthusian monasteries are definitely there in the concrete. There is the thing of, like, the concrete can do anything that stone can do.
He's doing a lot of push and pull with the barrier, the outside. It's got kind of cuts and slits and suggestions towards things, and you're always not quite seeing out, or you see out only in these very controlled ways, or see in these controlled ways, which makes sense. It's kind of adding a degree of complexity to the core of the monastery, which is the wall, I think. The separation, anyway. I think we should stop it there, because everything that has been done since then that I can think of is terrible. Like the capitalist version that is very popular now, which is like, what if we could get everyone to live in blocks of student housing? Now there are enough students to live in student housing.
Yeah. Student housing forever. Wouldn't you like to pay £800 to live in a student room in your late 30s as a professional?
Worried about being able to cope on your own?
Yeah, they have pictures of like a lot of dead-eyed people cheersing on some adjacent sofas or...
Yeah, we work as a monastery also, not particularly appealing. And I also don't feel there has been a monastic movement, really. Literally there have, but I don't feel that there's been a great swing. Someone's done something new with monasticism. Apart from kind of monasticism as service, like a retreat monasticism is a sort of thing. Also, all that is solid melts into air, right? We're in late capitalism. Who the hell knows what's going on?
A fun version of it is, have you ever read Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed, which is a sort of anarchistic science fiction? But it, again, very much like it's all communal living. Everything's communal. And for resource-deprived communal living and sort of thinking through the experience and material culture of it. It's a great book. We should put it on the long list of things that we might talk about one day.
I think I'm super unlike a monk.
Which personality type are you? Yeah. Are you a butterfly or or a Kabbalist?
I'm not sure I'm either of those. I can think of people who, You might be a Kabbalist.
Yeah, I'm probably a Kabbalist.
You're more of a Kabbalist than me.
Sounds familiar.
I know a few butterflies.
They won't survive when winter comes. Whereas we Kabbalists have been laying
down. Kabbalists, yeah.
We've been making preparations for a long time.
Yeah. I like the spirit from which the Fourier stuff comes from. I think the reality of it, though, is actually, like, you cannot make it work with humanity, with the things that it makes it to be human, which are naturally, I think, exist in dialectic.
Yeah. I think I agree, though, with the vision of that we should strive to live in a world where people do a thing which they want to do.
Yeah,
and that's the most... I'm not sure that civilization is necessarily a term of abuse, but for me, that would be a civilized aspiration. I just like that it's a place that everyone loves. Good food, making love, healthy outdoor pursuits.
But also, you don't have to love those things. You can be with the people who don't love that stuff, you know. Yes. We're thinking of doing, I think, Jane Jacobs next. Is that right? And I was reading about that a little bit and thinking about the problems of... the strengths and problems of the village.
Yeah. Yes, which is definitely a thing.
And they have a relationship with this. It's like, how can you make the village work? There's things you can do. When architecture sets itself such lofty ambitions, it's going to be hard-pressed to meet them. Better shoot for the moon, eh?
Yeah, I think so. It's a nice thing to live in the ruins of.
Oh, I don't know. Is it? Maybe.
I think it's nicer to live in the ruins of, like, lofty ambition than in the, like, bare fulfillment of sort of hopelessness.
Cool. Well, we will leave you either in the cracked, broken dreams of your utopian ideals or in the bright future of adequate food, which we've been promised.
Oh, yeah. Let's see. It's a roll on 2021.
Yeah.
Yes, well, you've been listening to a podcast about buildings and cities, I guess. You could, if you want even more, our bonus episodes are flying off the shelves at patreon.com/about_buildings. For $3 a month, you can receive an extra one with every episode.
If you've listened to all of them, which seems almost impossible.
Some people have.
There is, yes, quite a lot more.
We've been doing some quite interesting stuff of late on those. Thanks to everyone who's written in. We're aboutbuildingsandcities.org has all of the links to the socials and the emails and things like that.
Thanks for all the nice reviews. We've had some nice ones.
Yeah, much appreciated. Spreading the good word, you know, hither and yon on the platforms.
Yeah.
Always much appreciated.
It's very kind of you.
And thanks also to Matt, who's been producing some excellent allied social media content with lots of improving pictures and kind of explanatory material, which is worth getting onto whichever of Twitter or Instagram you find less objectionable for.
Twitter, I feel, is the disappointed reality, and Instagram is the frustrated desire. One is about display, one is about anxiety.
So anyway, it's been fun having you with us, and we'll be on to something next. Something else. Yeah.
Difference. Yes. We've got to do a bonus for this thing.
Yeah, we will. We'll do that.
Yeah. Turns out Jane Jacobs is more like this stuff than you would expect.
Yeah.
Spoiler for later.
Oh, well. You've got that to look forward to. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. Good night. Народ кавказский, любим любовь и ласки, если мы обманут ласки, ба. Будем и дурной ходить, и тащить тяжелые, а потом ее крепим, чтоб не убежали. Кавказки любим, любовь и ласки, если обманут глазки, ба. Будем и дурной ходить, и точить кинжалы, а потом ее крепим, чтоб не убить.